This was his land, and he did not want to share it with another. Especially, he did not want to share it with that monster of cruelty and conceit that was his father. He stared coldly at the inscription that followed the name and date, but inwardly he seethed with anger and resentment. "In God's holy name," the words were carved below his father's name. It was typical of Fuller Ballantyne that he should carve his own name here with a cross and credentials as the Lord's ambassador, as he had on trees and rocks at 100 other places across the continent, which he regarded as a personal gift from God. "You were right, Zuga dear. You are leading us to him. As you promised, I should never have doubted you." If he had been alone, Zuga realized that he might have defaced that inscription, scraped the rock bare with his hunting knife. But as he had the thought, he realized how futile it would be, for such an action would not wipe out the ghostly presence of the man himself. Zuga turned away from the rock wall and its taunting plaque. He stared out over the new land, but somehow his heady pleasure in it had been dimmed by the knowledge that another man had passed this way, ahead of him. He sat down with his feet dangling over the sheer drop to wait for Robin to tire of staring at her father's name. However, the caravan of porters came before she did that. Zuga heard the singing from the forested slope behind the pass long before the head of the line crossed the saddle. The porters had voluntarily doubled their own loads, and they struggled up the slope under the enormous weight of elephant meat and fat and marrow bones, bound up in baskets of green masasa leaves and bark rope. If Zuga had asked them to carry that weight of trade cloth or beads or even gunpowder, he would have had an immediate mutiny to deal with, he thought grimly. But at least they were carrying the tusks. He could see them near the head of the line, each tusk slung on a long pole, a man at either end. But even here they had hung extra baskets of meat on the same pole as the tusk. The total weight must have been well over 300 pounds, and they struggled up the slope uncomplainingly, even cheerfully. Slowly the caravan wound out of the forest and entered the gut of the pass, beginning to move directly under where Zuga sat. The figures of the porters and of Yan Shirut's Hottentot musketeers foreshortened by the angle. Zuga rose to his feet. He wanted to order Yan Shirut to camp just beyond the point where the pass debouched onto the foothills. From where Zuga stood, he could see a patch of green grass against the foot of the cliffs far below him, and a pair of pale grey herons hunting frogs in this verdant marshy area. There was certainly a spring, and with the meat upon which they had gorged, his servants would be burning with thirst by nightfall. The spring would be a good place to camp, and it would allow him the following morning to copy and record the bushman paintings in the cavern. He cupped his hands to his mouth to hail Yan Shirut, when a crash like the broadside from a ship of the line filled the pass with thunder that echoed and bounced back and forth between the cliffs. For many seconds Zuga could not understand what was happening, for the thunderous bursts of sound were repeated, almost drowning the thin screams of his porters. They were throwing down their burdens and scattering like a flight of doves under the stoop of the falcon. Then another movement caught his attention. A large round shape went bounding down the scree slope below the cliffs, charging straight at his panic-stricken caravan. For a moment Zuga believed it was some sort of living predator that was attacking his servants, and running along the lip of the ledge, he unslung the Sharp's rifle ready to fire down into the pass as soon as he could get a sight of one of the dark bounding shapes. Then he realized that at each leap the thing struck sparks and fine grey smoke from the scree slope, and he could smell the faint smell, like burnt saltpeter, that the sparks left in the air. He realized abruptly that they were giant rounded boulders rolling down upon his caravan, not one, but a dozen or more, each weighing many tons, an onslaught which seemed to spring from the very air itself, and he looked wildly about for its source, goaded by the screams of his men and the sight of the rolling boulders smashing open packs of his precious, irreplaceable provisions and scattering them across the rocky ground of the saddle. Far below him, he heard the thudding report of an Enfield rifle, and glancing back he saw the tiny figure of Yan Shirut aiming almost directly upwards at the sky, and following the direction of his rifle, Zuger saw movement, just a flicker of movement, on the edge of the cliff, outlined against the blue soaring vault of the heavens. The deluge of huge boulders was coming from the very top of the cliff, and as Zuger stared, another and then another came raining down into the pass. Zuger squinted his eyes, head thrown back, as he studied the cliff rim. There was some animal up there. Zuger did not at first think of man, for he had already convinced himself that this new land was devoid of human presence. He felt an almost superstitious chill of horror that some pack of giant apes was on top of the cliff, bombarding his men with huge rocks. Then he shook himself free of the feeling and looked quickly for some way to get higher up his side of the pass, to reach a position from where he could fire across the rocky gateway at the attackers on the opposite cliff and give some protection to his servants. Almost immediately he discovered another ledge, rising at a steep angle from the one on which he stood. Only a soldier's eye would have picked it out. The tiny feet of the little rock hyrax had used it and put a light sheen on the rock, and it was this that had drawn Zuga's attention to the narrow pathway. "Stay here!" he shouted at Robin, but she stepped in front of him. "Zuga, what are you going to do?" she demanded, and then before he could answer, "Those are men up there. You cannot fire upon them." Her cheeks were still smeared with tears, but her pale face was set and determined. "Get out of the way!" he snapped at her. "Zuga, it will be murder. That's what they're trying to do to my men." "We must bargain with them," Robin caught at his arm as he pushed past her, but he shook her off and ran to the higher ledge. "It will be murder!" Robin's cry followed him, and as he climbed, Zuger was reminded of the words of old Tom Harkness. The accusation that his father would not stop at killing anybody who stood in his way. This was what he had meant, Zuger was suddenly sure of it. He wondered if his father had fought his way through this past, just as Zuger himself was about to do. "If the champion of the Almighty can do it, then what a fine example to follow," he said to himself as he went up the steep ledge. Below him the Enfield rifle thudded again, the sound muted by distance, almost lost in the roar of a new avalanche of murderous rock. Jan Schroot could only hope to discourage his attackers with rifle fire from that angle. Only if one of them actually leaned far out over the edge of the cliff would he be vulnerable to fire from the gut of the pass. Zuger climbed in cold anger, stepping unhesitatingly over dangerous spots in the narrow ledge where small pieces of rock crumbled under his boots and went rattling into the pass hundreds of feet below. Abruptly he came out onto a broader ledge, formed by the strata of rock, which rose at a gentler pitch, so that now Zuger could run along it without fear of losing his footing. He climbed swiftly. It was less than 10 minutes since that first boulder had come crashing down into the pass. The attackers were continuing the bombardment. The hills reverberated with the crash and rumble of flying boulders. Ahead of Zuger on the ledge, a pair of tiny grey clipspringer went bouncing up over broken rock, seeming to flit on the tips of their elongated hooves, terrified by the men and the rumble of falling rock. They reached the corner of the ledge, and one after another they made what seemed suicidal leaps out into space, phenomenal leaps that carried them 40 feet to the next sheer wall of rock, rock which seemed devoid of foothold. But they clung to it like flies and scrambled swiftly up out of sight over the top of the cliff. Zuger envied them that bird-like agility as he toiled up the steep incline, sweat soaking his shirt and streaming stingingly into his eyes. He could not stop to rest, for far below him a thin wailing scream of agony told him that at least one of the flying boulders had struck down a porter. He turned another steep corner in the goat track, scrambled over the rim, and was suddenly out upon the flat table-like summit, dotted with little clumps of broom bush and sparse, stiff yellow grass, like hedgehog quills. Zuger threw himself down on the edge of the plateau, heaving and straining for breath, and he struck the sweat from his eyes, peering across the deep void of the pass at the cliffs on the opposite side. He found himself on a level with the heights opposite. It was 300 or 400 yards across, easy range for the sharps, though one of the smooth bore 4 to the pounds would have been hopelessly inaccurate at that distance. While he primed the rifle, he studied the ground opposite him and saw almost immediately why the attackers had chosen that side of the pass in preference to the one on which Zuga lay. They were on a flat-top pinnacle of sheer rock, with no visible access to it from any direction. What path there was would be secret and highly defensible. The attackers had an inexhaustible supply of missiles, for the rounded boulders were scattered everywhere upon the heights, varying in size from that of a man's head to that of an elephant carcass. And as Zuga watched them, they were using heavy raw timber balks to lever one of these over the edge of the cliff. Zuga's hands were shaking, and he fought to bring them under control. But the Sharp's rifle wavered as he tried to take a sight on the little group of men across the open void of space. There were not more than 2 dozen of them, all of them naked, except for a brief kilt of leather, their dark skins polished with a sheen of sweat in the sunlight. He was regaining his breath swiftly, and now he wriggled forward on his belly and propped the stock of the Sharp's rifle on a rock in front of him. It was a dead rest, and as he levelled his gaze over the open sights, the group of men succeeded in working the huge boulder over the edge of the cliff. It went with a brief grating that carried clearly to Zuga, and then it fell with the soft rushing of eagle's wings, until it struck again in the pass 200 feet below, and once again the hills rang and rumbled to the force and weight of it. The little group of black men had drawn back from the edge of the cliff, resting a moment before they selected another missile. Only one of them wore a headdress. It looked like a cap made from the mane of a male lion, long tawny hair tipped with black. It made the other man taller than his companions, and he seemed to be giving orders to them, gesticulating and pushing those nearest to him.
"You'll do, my beauty," Zuga whispered.
He had regained his breath now, and the sweat was cooling his back and his neck. He pushed up the leaf of his back sight to its 300-yard adjustment, and then settled down on his elbows to peer over it. The rifle was rock steady on its rest, while he took a fine bead on the man with the lion headdress. He touched off the shot, and while the crack of it still stung his eardrums, he saw a tiny chip of rock fly from the lip of the cliff across the valley.
"Low, but very nicely on line," he told himself, opened the breech of the Sharps, and forced the paper cartridge into it.
The shot had startled the little group of men. They peered about them, mystified, not certain of what it was, or from where it had come. The tall figure in the headdress moved cautiously forward to the edge of the cliff, and stooped to examine the fresh chip on the ironstone rim, touching it with one finger. Zuga set the cap, and thumbed back the hammer. He gave it a full bead, and aimed at the waving yellow headdress, set the hair trigger, and then, with a lover's touch, stroked the curved trigger. The bullet tolled loudly, a meaty slap like a housewife beating a carpet, and the man in the lion headdress spun round sharply, his arms jerking out wide, his legs shuffling in a grotesque little dance. They collapsed under him, and he flopped on the very edge of the cliff, like a harpooned catfish. His companions stood frozen, making no effort to help him, as he slid towards the edge of the cliff, and a final spasmodic jerk of his legs tumbled him into the void. He fell for a long time, his outspread limbs spinning like the spokes of a wagon wheel, and there was another meaty thump as he landed at last on the broken scree slope far below. Zuga fired again into the tight knot of men, not attempting to single out one of them, and he hit 2 of them with a single bullet, for even at that range the Sharps could drive the hardened lead bull through a man's body with hardly any loss of velocity, and the group was bunched up. As the ball whacked into them, they split into separate racing figures, their yells of fright carrying clearly to where Zuga lay. And before he could fire again, they had disappeared into a narrow, rocky gully with the miraculous speed of a troop of little furry hyrax. The silence was sudden
and startling after the uproar of falling boulders and heavy gunfire. And it lasted for many minutes, broken at last by the shrill voice of Yan Shirut calling up from the deep gut of the pass. Zuga stood up, and hanging onto the branch of a monkey orange tree, leaned out over the edge of the cliff.
"Take the caravan through, sergeant,"
he pitched his voice to Carrie, and the echoes mocked him with his own words.
"Sergeant, sergeant, sergeant, sergeant. I'll cover you, cover you, cover you, cover you,"
taunted the echoes.